This is the second session of the interview with Robert Hocus. This is now the 16th of December. And I'll start off with a question of how much you knew of the appointment of Pound and the pressure that was put on to appoint, by people on the state to appoint Aldrin.
I don't think I know a great deal. I recall, of course, that there was there were those in the state who were attempting to get Aldrin appointed, but I had no way of knowing how much of a momentum it might have.
Well, this would have made it better. I mean, how would Aldrin have been a dean?
I think he would have made a good dean. His type of leadership is quite different than Pound's. Pound is a very dynamic person, a very positive person.
He said, you must have seen a newspaper article about him and called him a curmudgeon.
Yes. So, but Aldrin, I think, would have done a fine job. He knew the university, he knew the state, he knew the industry. He would have provided good leadership, but it would have been a different type of leadership, probably more low key than Pound.
So less pushing for the cult, which is what the counter-reputation was.
Yes, I think that's right. Pound also had a very deep understanding and a high respect for fundamental and basic research, and this came through again and again. I don't know how to measure that with Aldrin. I wouldn't suggest that he doesn't understand it, but I don't know how much he would have actively promoted in the way that Pound did.
Mm-hmm. That sounds as if that would have been an important. Well, you don't know how Aldrin would.
No, one does know unless he would have had the opportunity to be dean. But I observed many times Pound's position on all sorts of things. Most frequently, I expect, was in relation to faculty appointments. And he was always urging the departments to be sure that the individual had a good, solid science background, basic science background, regardless of what department they were in.
They were to the point of rejecting appointments by departments?
Yes. I recall on more than one occasion he would simply send back, they would send up the CVs of candidates that they thought they'd like to invite for an interview. And I recall more than once he'd simply send them all back and said, "These just, in my mind, aren't worthy of your consideration. They aren't the qualities that you should be looking for."
Oh, that is interesting.
He exercised very high standards, in my judgment, although he'll be remembered for perhaps the building program, because it was a substantial increase in the buildings on the agricultural campus during his tour of office. My own feeling is his contributions to maintaining very high standards and expecting the best from the faculty and expecting in recruiting that they really seek the top flight, as he used. I think he used the word frequently, a blue ribbon type. Probably was one of his major contributions. He had a very solid impact on maintaining very high standards.
Kroger wouldn't have been doing that, so there must have been.
Not that I, well, of course, I was only with Kroger for a short time, relatively. I don't recall his ever giving it of any thing that would have given me that kind of impression about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you expressed yourself on the subject of overhead after we turned off the tape last time. I hope you'll say substantially what you said then.
Well,
Could you sort of go at it chronologically and when you began to think about it?
The first concern that I recall having with respect to overhead was within a year or two after I was in administration. At that time, there weren't a great many faculty who had grant support, but it was growing and growing rapidly. And one thing that, by the time I was in the administration, it was clearly understood that the overhead was not something that we, the faculty or the college administration, could expect to have anything to say about. There was always.
When did you start? Do you remember how you noticed that?
Well, yes, I do very distinctly, because of, we had a young member of the faculty who had, in more or less, inherited an Atomic Energy Commission grant, and he came to me. He inherited from Dr. Brink. When I say inherited, Brink retired. Carmichael was a co-investigator with him, and then he took over and continued with it. And it was rewritten for renewal, and Dr. Carmichael came in to discuss it with me, to get any suggestions I might have, and particularly to discuss the budgetary aspects. Well, almost as he was leaving, as I remember, and he made the statement, and I assume, and this is his words, I assume I will have access to the overhead. And I said, no one has access to the overhead. He said, well, yes, I do. And I said, well, that's information that I have never had before. And I've been in the office for about, by this time in the office of administration, I expect a year and a half or something like that. Well, you can be assured, when he left my office, I quickly began to ask questions that apparently I didn't realize should have been asked before, because I went back to our business office and told them what had happened.
Yep.
To our college business office. And told them, I've just had this conversation with Professor Carmichael, and this one I related to me. I said, I thought there was no overhead made available to anyone. And they said, oh, there is an exception. Well, I'd like to know more about that exception. Well, as it turned out, there were six faculty who, at that time, in various departments in our college, had support from Atomic Energy Commission. And all of them got all of the overhead back, personally. I mean, that to their accounts.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, or more, I should say, more interestingly, were most of the funds that are, practically all of the funds that come on the direct costs in a grant are listed within budget lines, that is, salaries and wages, supplies, capital. The use of the overhead was open-ended. They could use it as they saw fit. This just amazed me. I couldn't understand. It didn't make any sense. And I said, well, what does this amount to? Well, it turns out, as I remember, it was over $26,000 annually that was parceled out and prorated based on the overhead that was being generated by these six grants. So I attempted within our office to find out how that had happened. I said, now look, we've got a number of AEC supported faculty that don't have that overhead. Why are these people getting it? Oh, they came early. And since then, they said no more of this. But they've grandfathered in these six people. And I said, well, I'm just mystified. I don't understand. I said, well, is there any NSF like this? No. Any NIH? No. And I said, well, who would know something about this? And one of our people in the business office said, well, why don't you call George Everson? So I called George Everson and described this to him and said, can you enlighten me on what happened? And he laughed, and as I remember, he said, what I'm going to tell you, you will hardly believe. And then he proceeded to unravel, which is a very interesting background. And the essence of it, without going into all the details, was that in the very early days of competitive grants, apparently the decision was made by the top administration that overhead would not be filtered back, that it would simply be used for, well, it was one where, as far as I know, the deans were never consulted, the faculty were never consulted, it was just used as a fund by top administration. This would be the president's office at that time.
When you say the very early days.
Well, because from the outset, this policy was placed, and from the outset of grants, there was never, as far as I know, there was never on this campus any allocating back to the generating units in the way that other campuses have.
I guess I was trying to find out, this was first done in a UDB trip, because I think there must have already been.
Well, maybe it could have been. There was there, but it could have started there. I guess I was under the impression it was when Harrington was president. But in any event, it was the part I'm going to relate now in relation to these exceptions occurred during Harrington's office. There was a group of faculty, as I understand it, in the Department of Physics. And at that time, of course, physics would be getting fairly substantial amounts of money from AEC. And I don't know the background, I don't know that Everson gave me much detail. He said, except that somehow they were determined they were going to get some of that overhead, and they went. And some of them apparently were quite well recognized nationally. And whether they talked to AEC officials or what, I don't know. But at any rate, it was brought to the point where apparently it was almost explosive. And there was an agreement made that all of those who had AEC money would get their funds. But it was done very, very quietly. No one, very, very few people knew this. And they, in order to be consistent, they gave it not only to the Department of Physics, but to all others.
Oh, I see. That had
AEC money.
Yeah.
Well, apparently that, once taken care of, and I don't know what happened that made this situation where they didn't continue it, because that was the part that puzzled me, is why wasn't all AEC money treated in the same fashion? Well, as it turned out, it was in that time frame when those people raised the matter and were willing to apparently try to take it further, agreements were made, and then they were just, that was kind of built in from that point on. So, well, the only reason for getting into it is that, as far as I know, that's the only time that departments or and individuals were receiving any of the overhead in any direct fashion. And as I pointed out earlier, a good many institutions do have an arrangement where, say, 25% is taken at the administrative level, let's say at the chancellor or president's level, and then 75% might go back to the college, and the college would take 25% at their level, and then 50% would go back to the department or something like that. So that And of course, the amount of overhead generated is very large. It's now 43% of the direct cost. And the part, my point of bringing it up is that is simply one of not understanding how anyone could have, who had spent time on this campus and knew the value of the wharf money, as I mentioned to you before, and what it does to promote research, how they would not have recognized that a great deal more could have been done in terms of productivity to enhance research if some policies had been set up that encouraged the faculty to be more aggressive in seeking funds. To be specific, it's not unusual that even a successful grant getter might come at a period of time, and let's say he's had a grant and maybe it's been renewed once or twice. And meantime, he's built it up where he might have some technicians on it, postdoctors, perhaps some graduate students. And then, even though the agency might agree it's a quality proposal that he sent in for renewal, but at that particular point in time, they simply didn't have the money. So they would say, you get a high ranking in terms of the peer review of your proposal, but we just can't fund it at this time. It seems to me that with the previous experience that we had with WARF, it would have been quite independent of filtering it back, as I indicated many institutions do, to the point where it's generated. It would have seemed to me to be a very good investment to set up an insurance fund out of overhead, so that those individuals on the faculty who were scrambling to keep their grant support program alive would know that within reason they couldn't go on for ad infinitum, but if they were caught for 3 months or 6 months, they wouldn't have to dismiss their technician or close off the postdoctor or whatever. The graduate school does some of this, but it seems to me that with 43, in our college, more than 43% of the money comes from competitive sources that for research. It would make good sense to try to reason through how you promote and how you try to enhance that kind of a program at the grassroots, namely the individual professor, so that he knows that instead of, I think it's very common now, most, if you talk, I think if you just took at random, 10 individuals from anywhere in the university that had grants and asked them about overhead, you'd find they're very unhappy about it. Even though they're told repeatedly, well, you get it back, you get this and you get that, and I'm sure they do to some extent, but it's a very intangible thing. And the part that I think was missed in that decision not to set something up was an individual or group of individuals simply weren't recognizing the kind of a treadmill that most of our faculty are on in order to get grants and to hold them, and that the anxiety that they have to go through in order to wonder whether they're going to get a renewal on time, and if they do get the renewal, that it will cover all their costs. And this is, as I leave the university, this is one of the things that just, first of all, mystifies me that it ever happened. Secondly, the fact that it happened just astounds me, because I can't understand how anyone could not have, particularly, and I keep going back to WARF, because we had that as an experience. We knew what you could do by investing with the faculty. And here was a sum of money, and I'm not arguing that there aren't real costs, I should say, that need to be covered by overhead. There definitely are. But even if you look at that cost, most of the cost of most projects is located at the laboratory where it's going on. Mm-hmm. not somewhere else. So that even if there needed to be a certain percentage used to cover administrative overhead, to cover the paperwork, to cover secretarial work and all this, which clearly needs to be covered, and let's say the servicing of the building. Yet in the end, the major cost, and I don't know what percentages might be, but I would say it's well above 50%, must be at the level where the work's being done. I don't, and that, by that I mean the heat, the light, and everything else. And somehow, even if it had been a matter of a paper budget, it would have had a very stimulating effect, and certainly morale would have been much higher. Even if you handed it to them with this hand and took it away from this hand, they would have said, yes, I know, and I feel it. I can relate to it. Mm-hmm. And so, well, anyway, it's one of those things that I have found. No, let me go further, though, and give credit to Chancellor Shane, because as I remember during his vice chancellorship, he, I think, probably because he came from a department where he chafed under this situation too, began to try to feed some of it back. And that has been, there's been a pattern of that occurring now for, well, it's, I think it's more than, it must be 10 or 12 years. But it's only a small portion. It's a relatively small portion that gets back simply because, and I have no way of knowing where else it's been committed, but it's been committed to other things that make it impossible to give more than a small amount.
You did speculate a bit last time as to where it might have gone.
Well, but that is speculation. That is speculation.
It's interesting. I mean, I did too.
I think it's the rumors have it that it was spent even off this campus.
From Milwaukee. And
right. That's the rumors. I don't know whether that's fact or fiction, but there were large sums of money that were, something happened to it. I think there was considerable expansion of faculty occurred on soft money that later had to be picked up in one way or another. Programs, I think, were established, new programs on the overhead money.
The Institute for Research and Humanities was established about that time.
Well, these type of things, I think, may very well have been where some of it went, but again, it's speculation.
You said something about the medical school.
Well, at one time, I know that I remember hearing a remark and this was quite early. By that I mean it would have been 15, 20 years ago, by Jim Crow, and I think it was at a biological division meeting. And I don't know why the subject was brought up, but he pointed out that an amazing number, in percent, at least to my ear, it was something like amazing number of the faculty were salaried in part, or, well, I guess you could put it in part, on grant money. And
medical school.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, obviously this is probably on the direct cost. But if these faculty obtain tenure and they don't renew their grant, that come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And there was a considerable expansion. Well, there was a lot of expansion going on. And my guess is that some of it went into brick and mortar, some of it went into new positions, both faculty and administrative. Some probably went into support staff. I mean, these are, again, speculation, but with a huge amount of money that's involved, it had to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's probably what it is.
I did find a sheet that would have illustrated this quite well. It showed the overhead, the income from overhead, it added it up. This was the 1 year, and then the next year, and then the next year. And then from the total, it deducted the physics department's return, and then a president's, I think the term was special fund or something like that, that was also deducted, and then it left a certain sum of overhead. And that, when you say physics,
yeah.
There it was.
Right. Well, anyway, it's one that I've I've always felt that it was very poor decision made. I'm not arguing that some of the new programs that are established, and even not arguing that some of the, maybe all of the faculty that were hired are excellent. That's not the point. I think, though, that if we recognize that in order to drive the research machine of this university, it's absolutely essential that competitive grant money be obtained, and most of it's obtained by the individual faculty, then it seems to me we ought to be very businesslike in terms of how we help those faculty, assist them and encourage them, and recognize them instead of the reverse. As I said, I think if you picked at random any 10 people and asked them, are you happy with the overhead situation? The grant getters, and I'm not talking about the non-grant, because yeah. they might yeah. be very happy.
Yes.
The grant getters, I would wager, you will find either all or a strong majority saying no, they're not happy.
Well, particularly, I should think, dissatisfying to have a go out of the college.
Right.
I
think they would...
out of the ag college
right.
to go...
Because of the other universities, I don't pick this up. What it varies, but I have seen the information summarized in our central region. Something of the order of about half gets back to the department and that's generating, as I remember.
Wisconsin the only one that does?
No, I don't think so. I think there are others, but there are a number that have set up an agreement in terms of.
Do you remember any examples of programs that had to be stopped because the grant wasn't renewed for a period of time?
Well, I know in our own college, it wouldn't have been necessarily programmed because most of these, well, there are relatively few
research
big programs. The projects, yes. We've had to, with our own resources in the college, pick up appointments and simply provide the money necessary to carry them over.
You've done
that. Yes, out of other funds.
So when the graduate school did it, it would have been from four.
The graduate school did this for a while, and they may still do it to some extent. But they began, and they have situations where, well, they have a very rigid kind of a program that they will pick up under certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But the it's much more rigid than I think I personally feel is justified. I think that there needs to be more flexibility than they have in that program.
Take four of our interview. Did you ever get together with other people who were handling grant? I mean, Bob Doremus was in LNS and one of the other colleges. And discuss this question of overhead?
Not as a group. We had individual discussions about it. I never participated in any group discussions. I have often wondered if these kinds of discussions went on in the chancellor, the president's administrative group, where the group that were the chancellor, now the chancellor, then the president, had the deans come in, and I often wondered whether or not there wouldn't have been some discussion about the policy on overhead and its usage, but I have no recollection of any meeting where we as administrators at the college level met with other college people to discuss this situation.
You didn't Did it ever occur to you, think it would have been?
Yes, I did. I thought it would be worthwhile, and as a matter of fact, we took some action recently. Our college established a principal investigator committee, college-wide, and then began to look at various things, including the overhead and other grant-related problems or needs, that is, in the broad sense. Ultimately, it was proposed from our college through the Senate, Faculty Senate, that a principal investigator committee be established for the campus. It passed the Senate.
Was it there once?
No.
What happened to it?
I wish I knew. We submitted names from our college, and I think names were submitted from other colleges, for establishment of a principal investigator committee.
Yes.
The chancellor doesn't. We had a meeting with the chancellor, members of our faculty that are college principal investigator, and he and his staff to discuss it prior to the time it was introduced in the Senate. He at that time indicated, as you know, Chancellor Shane is very straightforward, outspoken person. He didn't agree with that concept. The reason we pursued it is that this university is known nationwide for its faculty governance, and it seemed absolutely not in keeping with that kind of faculty governance not to have a faculty committee that has something to say about one of the major activities, research, on the campus.
This committee of Joe Wilson's is different.
That was an ad hoc one time.
And it was a different problem anyway.
Yeah.
It wasn't how it was used.
Yeah, this wasn't necessarily how the purpose of the recommendation and then later the Senate's acceptance of a campus principal investigator committee was simply to have an orderly way in which the faculty could talk about their concerns, not just over him, but everything that's related to the problems and the needs and the opportunities in relation to grant getting on a competitive basis.
I'm just why Glenn Pound didn't make this an issue. I think he might have.
I don't know.
Did you ever talk to him about it?
Yes. Well, we had numerous conversations about it. I think Glenn would be confident, took it up with the Chancellor's office, probably even before that with President. I don't recall offhand. But I know that over time, the administration recognized that if there was a concern at the faculty level, that was probably, and there, we tested it by simply asking about it. Then it would be far more effective to have a grassroots kind of a concern expressed rather than we as administrators. We were active with them in the sense of talking to them about these things. I personally established the Principal Investigator Committee initially as an ad hoc group, and I met with them at their meetings.
Did they have somebody from biochemistry on it?
Yes.
Do you remember who it was?
Yes, John Suddy. And he was one of the co, we had two people that served as the chairman, co-chairman. One, Dale Norris from entomology, was one of the co-chairmen, and the other was John Suddy. Mm-hmm. And the committee simply carried along to the point. They talked, when we once got some experience and some momentum, they began to talk to some of their friends and colleagues in other colleges to simply acquaint them with what we were doing. So It's in limbo.
I almost thought you'd have a revolution. I mean, there's a very poignant letter from Hector De Luca to Councillor Young about the state of the biochemistry department, and he outlines all the grand things that they've done, and says we've got the poorest lab and the poorest amount of space in the practically the
well
campus.
Talking about Hector De Luca, he points out, and I think it's year in, year out, probably close to, well, to almost a regular event, that the overhead generated by that department pays for, in terms of dollars, brought in, will offset all of the dollars that are paid to their faculty from the state. In other words, they bring
their free department.
Well, that he likes to argue that in order to influence someone, if he can, that they, because at least in our college, they're one of the major graduate.
But they don't get any of it.
Well, they get, yes, I, as I indicated earlier, the Chancellor Sheen did begin to put things in motion so that the money does come back. Mm-hmm. There's been money provided that's built into the base. In some years, it's not very frequently, but some years that has been done. And more commonly, there's money provided for one-time expenditures, primarily capital, but occasionally some can be used for supplies, but it's got to be spent in that fiscal year. And it's been a significant amount of money. And we're duly appreciative of that, of having it. It runs, as I remember, it'll be in the order of 10 to 12% of what's generated. That's given back, and it's very important money. My reason for bringing this topic up is that I think it's nowhere near in keeping with what should have been done with an institution of this type.
Sounded to me like a very good point that you made. Were you aware of the consolidating rates for the Milwaukee campus and the Madison campus, so they were given the same percentage?
A WARF fund?
No, this is from outside grants.
No.
I showed you a letter there from Halverson to, let's see, who was it? Did he write it to you?
Oh, it's addressed to Bob. Clodius, right. Halverson is expressing concern about having salaries of the investigator in the direct costs of the grant. And I think I agree with what he's saying. First of all, this would take a great deal more money, because you'd have to carry a substantial amount of in the salary for the faculty member. And that's his argument, that you simply reduce the amount of research. And his point is that ideally the institution should be covering the salary costs, and that the grants then can be used for covering the operational needs and the additional personnel to carry out the research.
And Clodius's answer, which is that we're trying to get as much money out of the government as we can, so we get ourselves on soft money. Seems to be the statement of what happened, I guess, in the mid '60s that led to so much trouble later on.
Yeah.
Unless I'm misinterpreting it.
Well, I think I recognize it. It would depend on the institution. You've simply got, in some cases, to pay the salary in order to free up the time. In other words, if a person has a full-time teaching load and wants to do research, then it may be necessary to put some of the faculty salary on the grant, so that his time, that his state dollars can be used to hire a teaching assistant or something like that.
Oh, I see, yes, that's true. So that, as the enrollment was increasing, that would be an important consideration. So this isn't really quite the same thing that you're talking about?
No.
Well, I did come across, let's see, to all deans and directors, this statement that the faculty was disturbed about.
Well, there's been numerous letters like this, and some of them going into considerable detail, pointing out how, trying to justify, or justifying perhaps, but in my mind, trying to justify the expenditure on everything from the administrative costs to service costs to building maintenance, a whole range of things. There have been a whole series of letters, and they started out like this one, fairly general, and later on they began to get percentages, and the percentages would be changed a little in the next year, mm-hmm. and try it all because the faculty were expressing concern. So you will find those.
Yeah.
Okay, just for your own information, that, when we it did start out by, I mean, I remember pressing on the point myself with I think Bob Cooley saying, you know, we don't get it in any of the overhead. He said, oh, yes, you do. I said, well, where is it? Well, he said, it's in your budget. And I said, well, it's new to me. I'll go check it out. So I went to, at that time, Mr. Clogus, Harley Clogus, who's now with Extension, was our business officer. And I told him that I had visited with Bob Clodius, and that Clodius said, well, you get it, it's in your budget. And I said, Harley, how come I never knew about this? And he just laughed. He said, well, let me show you how it's in the budget. And the people that offered this is at year end, where they're showing where the expenditures were. Mm-hmm. Well, indeed, there were. There was money in several departments, and thousands of dollars. And I said, well, how does this happen? Well, and I, particularly when I these were running through, our Department of Agronomy had a fairly substantial amount. It seems to me it was between $20,000 and $30,000 showing as built into their budget by expenditure. And I said, how in the world can they be showing that if it has any relationship at all to the cost? Because at that particular point in time, the Department of Agronomy faculty had not a single grant. There wasn't a grant in that department at all. Yet there was a figure. But anyway, I was really puzzled by this, and Harley said, well, I can clear it up for you in a hurry. And I said, well, do it. I'm anxious to know. He said, well, here's what we were budgeted for at the beginning of the year out of our regular allocations from the state. And just look at one thing, look at the totals. He said, now look at the totals over here, where it says that we've got all this overhead in there. And he said, what you'll quickly see is that they're the same. Even though we had the budget of state dollars. And I said, well, where did the state dollars go? He said, who knows? In other words, what was happening, it's a bookkeeping kind of a process. And this just unraveled like a ball of yarn. It just, you kept getting just a little more information, a little more information. And anyway, at one point in time, and if you went back in one of the so-called red books, have the detail on appointments and the other funds. There was a time when the overhead, not just the overhead, but yes, the overhead, and because the other still carries a number, but the overhead had a number, an identifiable number, mm-hmm. like a 144, or what wasn't that, that was some number mm-hmm. that you could trace. Mm-hmm. So you could indeed trace it if you were persistent and want to spend the time. you could find out where it was and where it went. As this thing began to heat up, all of a sudden, you couldn't find that anymore. It was treated overhead money in terms of that particular portion, or that particular aspect, is treated just like state funds. Now, and I don't know where this, if you ask this question to George Everson, he might give you a different answer, but at least at one time I could go, or anybody else could go to, and track down. You can't do it anymore with the information that you can get out of the. And the reason that they gave us was that the legislature simply mandated that overhead be built into the budget. And that when they were mandated to do this, then they said, well, why treat it any different than state revenue? Mm-hmm. And so we'll just give one number.
Oh, I see. So this was a legislature.
Well, legislature.
To begin with.
There was apparently a period of time where the legislature really wasn't following or recognizing that there were substantial amounts of money coming to the university for this, these purposes. And when they finally recognized it, they said, well, fine, and from now on, that'll be built into your budget, so that as we look at your needs, you will have that as one piece, the overhead. And so that, whereas before, it was sort of an unknown to them, and in effect an add-on that allowed more flexibility. The flexibility, in part at least, within, probably considerably, was cut back when the legislature said, you now have X millions of dollars, but we say they've built in, and we know it, and you know it, and as we build a budget.
When did this happen, do you know?
Well, I think that too occurred in Harrington's period. There was a real flap, if you remember, if you were out here, with Harrington in some of the hearings before the joint finance. And I don't have the details in mind, but there was some major commitment made, and I think it was for when we first got into large computers, and there was a commitment made that somehow had to come out as a consequence of the discussions that went on, because it was such a large chunk of money. And I don't remember all the details, but it was something on the order of, well, how could you have made that big a commitment if you didn't have the money? Well, indeed, he did have the money, or they were going to get the money through the overhead, as I recall. Well, anyway, I don't remember the details of how it worked, but it was precisely. But there was a period in the time when the legislature were really upset because they hadn't been briefed or appraised, rather, I should say, of the overhead and the quantity of it, and maybe what it was being used for and all the rest.
But it sounds to me as if that would have put an end to the overhead as something the university could use the way it wanted to.
That's precisely, I think, what happened. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Have you ever thought you'd like to go back and see if you could track it all down?
Well, I think it would be fun, because some of the bits and pieces that I picked up starting from that day, when a very simple statement by one of our younger faculty said, well, I assume I get all the overhead back. And I said, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
He did know what he was talking about, because he was getting it back. And then George Everson's statement that what I'm going to tell you, you will hardly believe, because there must be some very interesting aspects to it.
It'll be interesting to see whether anybody would talk about it if I'm asked them.
Well, I expect it's a sensitive issue. I break it up because I was concerned enough about it that we changed
well,
about it.
Well, you were losing end, so naturally.
Well, all colleges.
But the people who were making the decision.
And we had some rebuffs in what we asked for. Well, to show you an example of kind, I'll give you one very specific thing that shows the kind of attitude, even though it's a minor item. I think this occurred under Froker. It was either under Froker or the very early days of Palm. We had a situation where, and we were one of the colleges that did not put many people, not the faculty's salaries on the grant line. We just had a very few. But one of those, in our Department of Entomology, who now incidentally is a full professor, had his substantial portion of his salary, and as I remember, it was around $8,000. Maybe it was all of it, but it was because these were years ago. And the grant wasn't renewed. And I don't think at that time the individual was tenured, but nevertheless, they had hopes of him tenuring. He was coming along fine in terms of productivity. And so this is the early days of this stewing about the overhead. We said, well, Bob Muckerman, who was the associate director myself, and talking about this situation after me, the department chairman had come up and told us that he was in a jam with this thing. We said, well, that's fine. This is a perfect place for the overhead. That's what it's for, in our judgment. So Bob Muckerman wrote a letter. He was the associate director to Bob Clodius, and simply outlined the problem and asked for funds from the overhead to cover this emergency. Muckerner never got a response to the letter, but our financial officer, Bob Hughes, got a response. And what it was the letter that Muckerner wrote to Clodius with a scrawled right across the face of it, Bob, Mr. Bob Hughes, take care of this out of your own resources. And so, in other words, this I think I tell this incident because it in my judgment, it correctly demonstrates the attitude that top administration had about overhead. It's none of your business. Just keep your hands off of it. And he was telling you, even if you're in trouble, you're not to ask it for it. You're supposed to somehow find your way out. Well, this I come back to the point that I want to repeat because I think it bears repeating, is it? Because I have feeling for it having done some of it myself. If you expect to have the faculty scramble and hustle for competitive grant money, and then when they're successful and they get it built up and they've got a good program, it's productive, it's training students, it's training postdocs, it's punching out good research, and then they come on some hard times, and you say, well, tough. You just work it out the best way you can. That's not the way to create an atmosphere that's conducive to a faculty wanting to continue to hustle. And we have had discussions one time, I did mention this, we did have a discussion about some of the general principles of overhead and at that particular time, several of the top administrators that came to a meeting over in our college, this is where some of the faculty came.
By top administrators, you mean people like Clodius?
Yeah, well, Clodius didn't come. We had Everson and Ruben Lorenz. I think Van Ness was there. And I remember faculty then trying to get a feeling for what might be done or could be done or in terms of more direct identifiable usage of the overhead in the way that they thought it should be used. And Dave Berman, who has had grants regularly and has had multiple grants, and those people, they are really on a merry-go-round and trying to keep those all together and keep it coming. I remember him speaking up and saying that after he listened to what had gone on, and in effect saying that I don't understand why I should continue to try to press so hard for grants if there's no more appreciation for what's being done by the faculty in terms of bringing in these dollars than there appears to be. And then he went on to say that I could just cut back to one role and my life would be a lot simpler. And I think this is the reason I brought the subject up to begin with, because I really feel it's so out of keeping with what this institution has stood for in terms of the faculty governance and in turn the support that they've had through the benevolence of the funds that generated out of vitamin D by Steve Block.
But what did these people say in response to him?
Well, the answer you get is that it's now built in, that the flexibility is not there anymore.
Did they say, I'm sorry?
Well, no, I don't think I don't think they'd like you to say that. I think it's just that they point out once the legislature were aware of it and demanded it be put into the budget, but that created restrictions. But that's only part of the story, because you see, if you take a simple, maybe an absurd example, if all of the money that had been used for overhead had been used only for one-time capital needs, major buildings, then once you paid that building off, the next year you have all of that money free. But what we keep hearing is it's not available. Well, then where is it? It's built into fixed and continuing costs of various kinds.
And they can count on those people like Dave Berman, in fact, wanting to go on having multiple grants counted.
Well,
I mean, has anybody actually said, well, that's it, I'm not going to bother anymore?
I don't know. I hope there hasn't been too much of that. I think some of them have not been as aggressive as they might be in terms of trying to keep too many grant-supported projects, because it means between writing in new proposals and conforming to the regulations on how you spend the money and make use of it, and writing the annual reports, I think some of them obviously say, well, there's a point of diminishing returns in terms of their own time.
But you don't have any dramatic examples of that?
No, Berman said this, but as far as I know, no one's ever reached a stage yet where they just said that they were not going to continue to compete. So it's fortunately that's not happening.
Yeah. So the state must have said, well, they'll go on getting it for granted, but we don't need to worry.
Been here long enough to go through, that went through that transition that I described, where one time you could, if it had been left as an item, identifiable item in the budget, it would be easy.
Yeah.
Once that change was made, so you couldn't track it anymore, then the only way you can track it is in books that somebody keeps in terms of how much money comes in from mm-hmm. that source. And then since you can't identify it by number, you would be memory, I expect, of somebody's memory of this program, that program.
Well, as I say, there are these charts of the overhead coming in,
mm-hmm.
and I guess they.
But where it goes, you see, that's the part you can't identify.
And you can't pin this down to any. You can't think of a year. You can't associate it with Kroger or Pound.
Well, I think the policy was made. Well, I'm sure the policy was made pre-Pound. It was made in the Kroger years.
Because Harrington came in 1962, but there had already been large grants.
The policy, the part when I, of course, began to be aware of it and to the extent that I've related, involved in some incidents were only after 62, because mm-hmm. I had simply been in research before that and had no way of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Young is somebody who seemed to know a great deal about what went on in the legislature.
Yes.
I wonder if he'd be somebody who would know.
He could. Might be a person. But now let me just change subjects, and I'm not going to spend much time on this one. But it's one that I wanted to comment on a little, and that is the merger. I think it was a real fiasco. It was it was sold to the public on a basis of being more efficient and more cost effective. And yet everyone who watched it and listened to it in their new and early stages, it was probably doomed to being very ineffective, as it has, and probably, if anything, maybe even more cost, because you build in another layer of administrative level. And the part that I think that's hard to understand, because I don't think this was done deliberately, obviously, by the governor and his and the group that supported it, but the move that they made early on, there were discussions and things that were being reported out that they wanted to be sure that there was not overlapping, that if there were some institutions that weren't really needed, that they would be cut back. All that discussion went on. And yet the governor made a move that just practically eliminated that possibility of ever happening by the way he handled the new board of the Board of Regents. Because he made it a political, it had politics in it before, all of them do, but they were not statewide so much, because they were, each of the institutions had their own, we had our own identity, and they weren't in the group. And I've never been able to understand how, and I guess not just me, but many others, how Lucy, as governor, reason that he could get what he wanted, and I think he was sincere in wanting to get more effective administration of the system, and that if that entailed cutting something out, that he wanted that, and I would guess the taxpayer would want it, and I would expect most of us to want it. But he promptly proceeded to appoint a much enlarged Board of Regents, and the way it was done was to make it so political from one end of the state to the other, and it's the logical thing to do in the end, but it's not the thing to do in the beginning. In other words, I don't understand why he didn't say, here are the things that are the essentials to make it effective, and I will accept nothing less than a very thorough study and recommendations that embrace those points. Instead of that, he just said the reverse. He pointed the Board of Regents, and as we all know, the minute you put your finger down on any institution and say, well, that one isn't needed, there's a hue and cry goes up for those that are representing that area. So the thing was, I think, really doomed to a poor success right from the beginning. And I think it was extremely unfortunate, and I remember a remark that I thought was so apt, that it just flew around the campus. Someone said, well, they didn't know what the merger would entail in overall aspects, but one thing was you could be sure of, that it would trim off the pinnacles of excellence and dump them into the valleys of mediocrity. Some wag. But at any rate, I feel that somehow, now getting to the point of more positive, I think somehow, hopefully, that the two doctoral institutions, Milwaukee and Madison, need to break out, not get independent, because I don't think that's politically possible. But they must, if we're going to survive and compete at the level we have been over the years past, get more flexibility in terms of our own resources, namely the budget, and in terms of faculty rewards and things like this, than the system allows. If we don't do it, I would sign under with my every assurance and seal it and say 20, 25 years from now, we will no longer be a front-running university because we can't compete. Mm. And we're locked into a system that won't allow anything else. So that somehow, and I give a great deal of credit to the attempts that are going on right now to for the chancellor and his staff and I know less well what's going on in Milwaukee, trying to find ways of accomplishing that. You see them in newspapers, and I think that must occur. And if it doesn't, it's going to simply mean it won't. In other words, there won't be any abrupt, in my judgment, the momentum that we have, the high recognition of the institution and the faculty just won't change overnight. If they'll have enough momentum, it'll keep right on going. But you can't continue to have major discrepancies in rewards that you've seen in the newspaper. In our college, for example, we're ranked in the very top in rankings. And if we just take some of our neighbors, or some of the top rank, the average salary of the professor at Cornell University is $8,000 higher. And you've seen the figures. In Minnesota, it's $5,000 higher. Even Michigan, with all their problems, I'm talking about our college, is nearly $5,000 higher. Well, I think it's not that our faculty are up for the monetary rewards. If they were, they wouldn't be at the university. They'd be somewhere else. But they certainly are not going to be content to be far below comparable institutions and colleagues there. And what I think it's hurting us in two ways, as the chancellor's pointed out. First of all, we lose some of our very outstanding people. But more than that, it's affecting recruiting. You can't hope to recruit, and the recruiting is in the next few years simply because of the large turnovers that are occurring in colleges and universities across the country. It's because of the clumping of ages due to World War II principally the rest, that the competition for top people is exceedingly keen. And every candidate who comes here is going to know, probably before they come, if they don't, they'll know before they leave, where we compete, about what level we can compete at. And so I think it's one of those things that I admire the efforts that are being made. But I don't think, at least any way I've been able to reason it, there's no way that you can do it and stay within the formal guidelines of the total UW system. Absolutely can't do it. Because you can't make the distinction between those that are carrying on an active research program, as our faculty here are, and those that are carrying on primarily a teaching program. And yet the way that it's handled by the legislature is that they're equal.
Yes, it's all quite the same.
Right.
I agree with you.
So I think that's one of the really great challenges that the chancellor and the president, of course, faces too. But the president's in a very difficult spot. How can he's the president of the system. He's got to have something that he can use to justify that kind of distinction. And an initiative, it seems to me, simply has to come from Madison, Milwaukee. He isn't going to say to Madison, Milwaukee, you look, I'll give it to you.
Yeah.
He can't do that. He's going to have some pressure. But I think he understands it and he'll be very anxious to try to do something about it if that pressure can be brought to bear. But the pressure has to be at the legislative level because they simply put you under a common set of rules, and it doesn't allow for the distinction between the faculty in the doctoral cluster as contrasted to those that are not.
You know, were you in on the letter Pound wrote to Chancellor Young about salaries in the ag club?
Oh, yes, very definitely.
It's a very long letter. I Xeroxed just the first page.
As far as I know, Glenn Pound never got an answer to that letter. Or if he did, it was noncommittal. That's one of the things that disturbed him very much. I'd be interested in having you check it and see, because at least...
I didn't see an answer.
I don't think there was ever an answer to it. There might have been something discussion, but I know Glenn was very, very disappointed about its having any impact on anything of an opportunity to try to cope with that the problem.
I wondered if there would have been, if one response might have been that ag faculty only had half the teaching load. I mean, I just wonder if that would have entered into it.
Well, I expect there may have been several things come out. That, plus the fact that they are an annual basis and things that would have had to be considered if you had a discussion looking at the pros and cons. But I don't think anything ever happened.
Well, the note on the letter says to take to, looks like IS, but maybe.
It says hold.
And then that's crossed out and it says hold.
Hold, and that's what apparently happened.
75. Well, it wasn't that Young was just becoming president or anything, is it? Mm-hmm. You can't do anything about that when the letter goes off and you don't get an answer.
No. Well, that's a difficult one.
You thought Pound was justified. Did you help? You must have helped him.
Oh, yes. We discussed this and had a hand in trying to put together the comparisons that were made, which were very carefully prepared. In fact, before they were submitted to Young, we asked the people in Chancellor's business office to look at them to be sure that we had made no incorrect assumptions or no incorrect interpretations. And we had their counsel on that before it went, because we thought there might be possibly something we didn't really either interpret correctly or that their base assumptions were wrong. But we didn't get anything that would bear on that from them, so we assumed that these were some, but we didn't get a response.
Is this still the case then? That relatively speaking, the salaries are lower?
Yes. That's true. Historically, the reasons for it, I'm not sure, but part of it obviously is that maybe the major part is that our faculty were hired at too low a rate, and beginning rate.
So that as they got raises, it didn't bring them up?
They couldn't keep up. I mean, if there was a substantial differential between the initial salary at appointment in our college versus some of the others, you never can make that up. Because it's always, well, some individuals might, but across the board you can, because everything is calculated against your base salary. Mm-hmm. When the legislature makes any money available for salary adjustment, it's against your base. And if your base is low per faculty, in contrast to someone else, you can't make it up. Mm-hmm. And so that apparently was a mistake someone made way back. I think it was a collective mistake that went on. I know that Pound began to urge hiring at higher rates, and certainly Walsh has continued that in terms of starting. So the younger faculty are are coming in at a better rate than others. The problem that creates, though, is a compression because of the way that you've seen the competition, that is our sister institutions, moving this beginning salary up for new assistant professors. That rate is moving faster than the money we didn't get even the legislature. So here you've got somebody you hired 3 years ago, and you hire at a rate that is equal to or maybe a little bit higher than what he is now has, because the percent increases haven't been those additive percent increases haven't equaled the change in the beginning salary rate. And what we do, and everybody I assume does that, you just call around and ask what others are, what are you starting people at this year? So, what it does then is this creates a compression within, and of course, some fair amount of dissatisfaction among the salary, among the faculty. They say, well, my God, I was there 3 years ago and I've been productive, and yet I'm getting less money than this new PhD who just come
here. Well, I think you talk about the School of Natural Resources as it files it very largely and of course it moves over into IES. Mm-hmm. And I know you were the acting associate dean for a while at School of Natural Resources.
Well, if I can answer that one, I think quickly, maybe you want more detail. It was a great idea because we did need, in my job, and even in retrospect, we needed more visibility for this type of thing, not just here, but around the country. I think there was a need. We were at Colleges of Agriculture, we didn't have that, even though there was a fair amount of activity in what could well call natural resources. The visibility wasn't there. And in terms of attracting students, in terms of attracting staff, in terms of attracting program money, it was needed, and it was a good recommendation that came out of the Holland study that Holland chaired within a couple of years after Holland was dean. That's one of the recommendations to establish a school. What happened is it was never nurtured very well.
After it was formed.
Right. It never received high enough priority in terms of the modest resources that were available to put it on track.
By Pound?
Well, collectively, by Pound and any attempt to get money from the normal sequence of sending it up the line to the request for new program money, just didn't occur. Pound would have only done it, unless he could get new funds, through the route of competition that goes on, through the chancellor's office and through, he would have to carve it out of existing resources. And the priorities for it, although they were considered to be worthy, weren't high enough to close out something else and redirect the money into. So as a consequence, although it's been reasonably effective and it's stagnated over where it probably should have gone. It should have simply had more resources, more faculty, and more program.
Well, people in other colleges thought that it would have been better to wait and have it become, didn't they, I think, on the whole, part of the some whole campus,
yes,
program of environmental studies.
Yes, that's correct.
And was it really in relation to the other agriculture campuses, or did Pound hope that maybe, I mean, this one gets that impression, maybe that he hoped maybe this, the UW effort in environmental studies would be this school?
I think they simply recognized there was almost a vacuum there, and that there was a need so critical that one could probably see it move. I think that's what happened.
But I mean, did he consider waiting and to see whether he might work in on the bigger program?
No, the move was made very quickly after the study group made their report. In fact, even before the report was finally printed, there was agreement that there would be an attempt to move to establish a school.
Well, so when there were the various committees studying what to do about a campus-wide environmental, and they said, well, we might as well let the schools start and give our approval because it's already underway. I mean, how did you look on this? When one reads the files, one gets the feeling of two groups that each want something very much.
Well, probably one could, looking at it from outside of college, one could argue that we were opportunistic, we moved on as a college. One can also argue, though, that to move on it at the campus level is much slower and unwieldy, because if you could imagine that it was so attractive and had so much sex appeal that the legislature says, great, we'll give you X million dollars to set it up. That's another matter. But I think most people, practically everyone, said, well, there's some risk to this, because if we start it, it's going to take something out of our present programs. Mm-hmm. One school after another would have had to do some of that same sort of reasoning. Say, well, if you start it and you can't get new money, where is it going to come from? And I think that the experience with IES demonstrates this, that it's very unwieldy. It's tough to get something going. When you've got well-entrenched colleges and schools, and where they're doing an effective job, and where whatever now pops up, unless it's very independent of what's been going on, and that's not likely, and certainly not true for environmental studies or for natural resources, there's, I think, some apprehension of saying, well, that's our camp. That's what we've really been doing that. We haven't been getting much visibility or whatever credit for it, but that's ours. We're doing some very good work there. And see, the LNS had this, and we had some, and engineering had some. And so if you make a move now, it might have been done at the chancellor level or the president's level, kind of mandated and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. But that's out of keeping with most things we do around here. It's got to start the other way. And as soon as you start at the grassroots level, you run into these things I've just described. And the IES thing struggled and struggled and struggled to get underway for some of those same reasons.
How much were you in on that? Because one of the complaints made in a letter, I think it was from Reed Bryson to Young, is that a group, I imagine it was the group that Dan Potter was associated mm-hmm. with, had been studying getting such a program going, but that Young had appointed a different committee altogether.
Yes. Well, I knew about this, and apparently they were doing some of this. I know. Reed talked with us about it. Our part of it started with Champ Tanner in Soils, who came and presented the case. And as I remember, after listening, he said, well, you really do have a good case. Let's appoint a committee. That's a typical thing. That's what everything is around here. And that committee was appointed. And that committee was active enough and got some momentum and got it to the stage where they, I have no recollection or reason to believe that we were in any way trying to upstage Reed Bryson's and what he was talking about, but we got more, our momentum came along faster, I think, than theirs did, in terms of getting it to the chancellor's level. Primarily, I think, because we maybe just took it on as a challenge and decided we would try to have enough meetings and get enough idea of what ought to be done and get a report together and see where we go.
Well, I was really thinking after that. I was, this is some perhaps 68 or 69. Mm-hmm. I mean, the School of Natural Resources is already formed.
Yes.
But Bryson is saying this is in connection with they were going to get a Rockefeller grant, mm-hmm. and the money was available, mm-hmm. and how it should be organized. Mm-hmm. And Bryson was saying, you haven't paid any attention to what we're trying to, we've been talking about. Do you know anything about that?
Well, that I thought that came up not so much in relation, maybe some of it came in relation to natural resources, but I thought it came up in relation to the move that we had on IES, when there was the Champ Tanner oriented thing, where we began to, John Ross and Champ Tanner and a group like this began to move it. That's the part I think that Bryson began to be the bothered about.
Was it Champ Tanner, that word, I don't remember seeing his name. John Ross figures.
Yes. Well, Champ is not that type of person. He's one of those very solid, he's not a promoter. He's very deep thinker, and is not likely to on his own move out on anything. But he was the one that really got us in our countries to begin to give the first thoughts to and to do something
about
the environmental studies.
About IES.
Yeah.
In the late 60s then. So you think there are two, it's coming from two different directions?
Well, I mean, yes. There had been, as I remember the way that Bryson's group, they had, instead of having a program like we did, an approach like we did, getting a committee and really sitting down and trying to put something together and draft it, theirs was one of having in lectures and invited people come in to look at this, that, and the other. And I think, I presume, they were doing that in terms of trying to create more faculty interest and concern about it. And then they were going to move into something of an action program. And I guess, as I said, with perhaps our approach might have upstaged them in the sense that we went at it in a different way. We simply tried to find a critical mass of people that were interested and would take the time to meet and talk about it. And we didn't attempt to educate the masses, so to speak. We tried to see if there weren't enough people to get it going, and did, and got momentum. And I've forgotten how many, 20-some odd or whatever it was, are involved, and from different backgrounds.
You weren't in on a meeting at Carl Runge's house, were you?
I don't
recall. This would be something like 1969.
No, I don't recall ever meeting in his house.
So it's quite interesting, because when people are recommending a director for the new IES, nobody, with one exception, recommends Reed Bryson. They recommend McKamey, who was in physical science,
right.
And John Ross,
right.
And somebody, Fox.
Forgotten what his background was. That's right. Oh, there was a lot of pulling and hauling.
So apparently Reed Bryson wasn't a popular candidate for this.
That's correct.
But do you know why? Do you know him at all yourself?
Oh, sure. Know him quite well. I don't know for sure. I think personality-wise, he's not one that perhaps endears himself.
Right.
John Ross,
right.
And somebody Fox.
Forgotten what his background was. That's right. Oh, there was a lot of pulling and hauling.
So apparently, Reed Bryson wasn't a popular candidate for this.
That's correct.
But do you know why? Do you know him at all yourself?
Oh, sure. Know him quite well. I don't know for sure. I think personality-wise, he's not one that perhaps endears himself easily. But I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think, again, speculation. But I know very definitely there were others that were looked at. Well, and the other fellow that... water resources in the engineering school. He must pick his name up. Went to Texas and now overseas. He was one that was looked to too as a possible.
Mm.
And as a matter of fact, I think he acted for a while
Well, there were Laos and Magnuson, Fox, Ross. O'Hare was in here. And these are just people who were recommended.
Well, but I don't know that he was recommended, but there, he actually helped steer it for a while.
And Rolick was a...
Rolick.
Yes, he was the director for a while.
Yeah, right. This is the one.
Oh, I see, and he went to Texas.
Yeah, he had another job opportunity. Right there in one opposite. In other words, I came to know Algren. Our morning coffee was a common place where we discussed things.
Morning coffee that Powell put an end to, you mean?
Yeah.
Did he completely?
No, not really. But he himself wasn't coffee. Right there in one opposite. In other words, I came to know Algren. Our morning coffee was a common place where we discussed things.
Morning coffee that Powell put an end to, you mean?
Yeah.
Did he completely?
No, not really. But he himself wasn't a coffee drinker. But I imagine Algren must have had some insight to the merger. I've always wondered. I have great admiration for Glenn Palm, but I have always wondered if a condition of his appointment, and this is again sheer speculation, would have been that he would accept the merger idea, because this idea of merger is so contrary, looking at it from a self-interest of the college. And I know that of the college, and I know that the faculty were by and large upset about this, and Algren definitely was upset about it in terms of the early stages of the merger. Later on, of course, he was brought in, as you know, the chancellor. But I'm talking about the formative stages when. We met in, where was it, Burge Hall, and as I recall, Harrington said it wasn't a matter of whether or not there would be a merger, it was a matter of when the merger would occur, in words to that effect. And I know that this created an enormous amount of discussion in the college and the faculty, not only there, but out in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And there was consideration of taking it to the state. In other words, creating a pressure group to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and I think Algren has a much better feel for that. My own feeling again, if Algren had been told to go out and rally the troops in the state, he'd have done it. That's my own feeling about it. Because
I can't remember where I saw this statement. I think it's in my notes somewhere, so I must have read it somewhere, or somebody said it, that it was a way of getting extension out from under the control of Palm.
Well, that may be in one way of looking at it. I don't know that I remember hearing...
Or maybe all went out from under the control of Palm.
That might make... to me, that would be much more... likely.
Why, in what way did Pound control?
Well, the administration of at many institutions of in the colleges of agriculture around the country, going back to the way that was structured to the federal legislation, the dean is also holds the title of director of the experiment station and director of extension. In other words, one person holds all of those, and he simply appoints associates to carry out the work. Well, that's been true here up until the merger. And so Henry Algren was associate director of extension under Pound. So that the way you interpreted that in your second remark, I think is probably more likely.
But Alcorn wasn't made director.
No. They chose a fellow, Neil, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And Alcorn was an associate director.
Still. Yeah, and people were very, again, that created a lot of storm around when they brought him in.
Where did he come from?
Well, he was from somewhere on east. I don't recall just where. I slipped from my mind, but you know, he left here and went to Maine and really got a baptism. But anyway, it was a very controversial thing. My own feeling is that although I understood what they were trying to accomplish in terms of improving general extension, looking at it selfishly from the standpoint of what extension does in terms of rounding out the total program and the effectiveness of our college, as research and extension and instruction all tied so closely together, it was a major setback, and still is. I think the effectiveness of the extension program as it relates to the college. Now, if you step back further and look at what happens as a consequence of making this merger and what it has done for general extension, then you have to recognize that there were things there that are positive, but viewed from our standpoint, mm-hmm. it was a setback.
How was the state affected by it? I mean, people.
Well, I think that the state lost something in that move as it relates to agricultural production. They probably gained something in terms of the broader activities that occur under general extension, because the organizational structure is one that was in place for agriculture, where it's tied so closely into every colony, is bound to have been a tremendous advantage for general extension to be able to just overnight to have, even though there were a lot of growing pains and how you make it work. But they just, with a stroke of the pen, they had a structure that permeated right into every single county in the state. Mm. And so it was a gain, definitely. So that many of the programs, I think, that General Extension had before, that had probably difficulty in really being able to get into the well-organized network in the state were vastly improved by this merger.
Well, I think that about
okay.
That's what I have to ask you.
Okay.
Is there something else?
No, I think I've given you points of view, and that's what you're asking for.
Yes, very, very much so. Thank you.
Thank you.